SCP-7600, 6 feet under, part one. Practically all of the wonders of the world were created using massive amounts of labor, dedicated towards a singular purpose, some of which have stood the test of time. While likely many of them were built with slave labor, they still represent some of the pinnacles of human achievement. Of course, in the SCP universe, there are a multitude of constructions that easily outshine anything created by mundane humanity, and SCP-7600 is certainly one of the most impressive. Like much of human history, however, there is a darker side to SCP-7600's grandiosity, one that the O5 Council will slowly come to understand. I'll note that 7600 is a sequel of sorts to the SCP-001 proposal, The Queen's Gambit, a reimagining of the Factory 001 proposal. In the canon of that article, Queen Mab of the Fae, along with her sister, established a vast empire across the world until the Fae split into two factions, leading to the fall of the empire. SCP-1000 then became the dominant species on the planet, until Queen Mab convinced humanity to overthrow them, resulting in the Day of the Flowers. The Foundation eventually got involved with a horrific factory and a fairy that they thought was Mab's sister, resulting in them eradicating the majority of the Fae population under the assumption that they all served Mab. It turns out, though, that the fairy is actually Mab herself, and the near genocide of the Fae became one of the Foundation's biggest mistakes. Knowledge of the events of the Queen's Gambit beyond this aren't really necessary to enjoy 7600, but it wouldn't hurt either. With that, let's take a look. SCP-7600 is a gigantic, biomechanical city megastructure located within the Earth's crust, inner, and outer cores, spanning approximately 200 million cubic kilometers. Samples recovered from its oldest section, alongside citizen records, suggest that it was built around 210,000 BCE, and it is the primary habitat hotspot for nearly all SCP-1000 instances living on Earth. It currently is host to over 2 billion citizens, who refer to it as the City of Druv'tul, short for Druv'tul al-Had, meaning the key to our final frontier in the Yeren language. The city is heavily reinforced by anti-mimetic and thaumaturgic seals that prevent accidental outside discovery and protect it from the naturally harsh environment. The city's physical makeup and society are each divided into 5 separate parts, referred to as rings. Despite their proximity, these rings do not interact outside of transportation systems between them, and they primarily differ based on their intended respective purposes. Rings 1 to 4 focus themselves solely on physical work, while the 5th ring, which hosts the aristocracy and king, is concerned with the maintenance of the thaumaturgical binds and rituals protecting the city. Although the buildings making up the different rings possess a variety of appearances, all of them are composed of a combination of metallic and organic materials estimated to be technologically ahead of humanity's current advancement. The primary goal and focus of all of these 7600 citizens is the sundown ritual, considered to be the central idea of their culture. It was deduced to be a hyper-complex thaumaturgical ritual that would utilize the entire area of the city and extremely specific and complicated markings laid within as its thaumic circle, focusing all energy harnessed towards the inner sanctum, where the king would then use it to complete the ritual. Although the exact characteristics of the ritual are unknown, recovered scripture and information retrieved from the king suggest that when finished, it would cause the creation of some sort of immensely powerful lantern construct. This construct would then guide the supposedly lost, godlike SCP-1000 instance, referred to by scripture as Fomet, allowing him to reclaim his guideship over his people. An excerpt from 05-4's A Study of the Culture of SCP-7600, discussing their nature, reads, "The culture the people of SCP-7600 bear is strange, frankly. These people focus their entire lives on nothing but torturous work, with no outcome other than the promise that one day, thanks to their sacrifice, they will bring their god back home. Perhaps it is due to more than 200,000 years of isolation from the outside world they've endured, but they do not seem to care about their fate. They cherish it, in fact. To be part of the greater whole is, to them, the ultimate purpose of life. They'd known nothing else for so long, so how could it be anything but that? The interesting thing, however, is that the rulers of Druv-Tul aren't different. From the most powerful politicians governing daily production rates to the king himself, they seem equally ecstatic about their goal. Of course, the fact that a big majority of their preparations are already complete must definitely help this view, but it cannot help but strike me as odd, at least. In all my years, I've seen nothing like this. Not once. To bear witness to a society devoid of anything but work, even crime, yet still maintaining normal people as its citizens is bizarre. One explanation is that their god, this Fomit they speak of, is simply worth all of the troubles. All material I've recovered that refers to the being describes him as a figure reminiscent of Buddha or Ion, a benevolent teacher to his kind, showing them the world for what it truly is. The stories I've read talk of him eventually departing for a great journey across the myriad of worlds out there, in search of more wisdom to pass to his children, after he gave them all knowledge he had, but I cannot help but feel a little suspicious towards this whole idea. We've never recovered any strong evidence to support the existence of someone similar to Fomit in history. But, on the other hand, nothing ever revealed or said by anyone within SCP-7600 even remotely suggests their plan focuses on anything else but a genuine will to bring back their beloved Messiah. I do not know what to think of this situation. I just hope that neither these stories nor the men that listened to them proved to be wrong." 7600 was discovered during the aftermath of the Great Chilean Earthquake in 1960, which was intense enough that it was initially believed to have been caused by anomalous influence, such as by a paraweapon or eigenweapon test in the area. Despite Foundation research concluding that it was ultimately an entirely natural event, retreating researchers did spot multiple humanoid figures in the area immediately following the earthquake's occurrence. Further research revealed that the Yeren originated from a large, previously undiscovered cave that led into 7600, and the earthquake had managed to damage the binds of one of 7600's anti-mimetic seals that guarded it against above-ground entry, resulting in the citizens sent to repair them being spotted by Foundation staff. A series of new scans and thaumaturgic echolocation practices conducted with the consideration of said seals then revealed the existence of 7600. Due to its significant size and potential relation to SCP-1000, the project and all further research was immediately promoted to level alpha priority. Before a manned mission could be dispatched, however, 054, who specializes in the history of the anomalous, especially Fey and Yeren-related fields of study, released a statement. It reads, "Ever since we founded ourselves amidst the chaos following the Sixth Occult War in the winter of 1870, the existence of SCP-7600, or at least something very similar to it, has been suspected by myself and my team. We'd always known where our second biggest neighbor, the Fey, lived. Avalon, as painful as its loss might have been, Esterberg, and High Brazil have been no secrets to any member of the anomalous world, but Yeren, or the Children of the Night, as we liked to call them back then, had no such place to call home. No matter where we searched or how hard we tried, it just simply didn't exist. So that was what we led ourselves to believe for over 90 years. And then the 22nd of May happened. I'd be lying if I said finally getting proof of SCP-7600's existence isn't exciting, to say the least. It's one of the biggest breakthroughs I've ever made in my study of SCP-1000's culture. For years uncounted, the mysteries of who the peculiar Fomet was and what the key he gifted to his kind is have trapped my mind. These questions were my primary drive forward here in the Foundation. So, to, after so many years, discover potential answers to them by pure luck is not just enthralling, it is exhilarating. I'd like it to be known to every Department of History doctor, every lone researcher with a passion for this field similar to mine, come to me. Come to me and you will be given a chance to explore SCP-7600 and its mysteries alongside me after we make first contact with Alpha-1. Come to me and together we shall finally put this puzzle together and make the riddle that is our past, present, and future into a fully comprehensive set. Come with me and O58 above ground, and we might just make the bright future we promised ourselves and the paranormal after the factory into a reality. I have but one simple request to all those who accept my invitation. Be careful. After what we'd done to those that lived in the forests, we absolutely cannot allow ourselves to bring the same fate to those that inhabit the lands below us. Because otherwise, that might finally prove to be what unmakes us. Before a bunch of excited researchers could get down there and start poking around, however, a 5-man team from MTF Alpha 1, Red Right Hand, is sent in to scope the area out. For ease of entry, they were transported via the usage of apportation as closely to the city's borders as possible, as direct teleportation into the city was deemed impossible due to the thaumaturgic seals. The closest possible distance was 500 meters, and due to the depth, the team was covered in a plethora of cooling and protective symbols which would absorb the heat from around them and protect them against pressure. The team teleports into a large cavern, the ceiling of which isn't visible in the darkness, and the team lead reports to command that all of them arrived unharmed. The team begins to head down a corridor leading downwards, cautiously, as a strong breeze of wind rushes through the passageway with no apparent source. They note that the walls are unnaturally even and smooth, and if it wasn't for the fact that the pathway was constantly descending, its frame would be a perfect, perpendicular 2-meter square. One of the members comments on the warmth they're feeling, not related to being so far underground, but a good kind of warmth, like when your mother hugged you as a kid. Another member remarks on how high their cognitive resistance value is supposed to be, but they just say that that's why it's so strange. The team lead breaks up the conversation by saying that they're dealing with an artifact from an age when humans weren't even around in their current form, so nobody knows what to expect. The walls are seen to be covered in a plethora of markings not found to be thaumaturgical in nature. They begin as simple shapes and lines, but over time turn into larger structures, eventually concluding in a red, serpentine slash that forms rough outlines of a small humanoid figure. As the walls continue, the figure morphs into more and more drawings, spawning a series of what appear to be working creatures, carrying chunks of rock and metal into giant, plant-like refineries. From there, they transport the material towards a castle, from which a large beam is ejected into a night sky, surrounded by stars. Above the palace, however, a single white border can be seen, separating the below from the cosmos, and the beacon terminates upon meeting it. This scene is repeated over and over, over the course of the 200 meters of wall the team passes. Suddenly, the sound of rapid footsteps is heard coming from behind them, though their radars do not pick up any heat signatures. The team stops, preparing their weapons, standing still in the darkness, before another wave of wind passes over them. They switch their vision over to Eve, revealing the entire cave to be glowing with heavy magic backlash, rapidly changing its Eve density and focus every second. The radiation dances around them like a flame, before vanishing and reforming into a humanoid shape in the distance. The shape starts to rapidly approach the team, with one member requesting permission to open fire, but the team lead denies the request, ordering them to keep running forward. They continue to quickly move ahead as the path starts to slide more and more downwards, and the markings on the wall turn into formations of gears, keys, and moon-like shapes. They grow bigger and bigger as the corridor becomes tighter and tighter, eventually forcing them into single file. Looking behind them, the figure suddenly splits back into three, and then into 5, 10, and 20, all rapidly approaching them. The team leader shouts into her radio for command to send backup, but the transmission breaks up. The team continues to move forward through the narrow corridor, before it suddenly terminates 2 meters above the ground of another chamber, causing them to spill into it. They quickly pick themselves up and keep moving, noting a blindingly dense opening seen on the far end of the chamber. Looking back, they see the figures all standing at the end of the narrow corridor, unmoving. They continue to watch the team's movements as they proceed towards the light, and the team lead tells the others to ignore them. Once at the threshold of the light, the team receives a transmission from command that sounds urgent, but it breaks up. The team lead tries to establish contact, but it just dissipates into static, so she swears, shrugs, and leads the team into the light. The camera feed cuts off for approximately 10 seconds, blinded by the intensity of the light, and when it reconnects, the team is standing in a large cavern. It's blindingly bright with Eve radiation, forcing them to switch back to normal vision, where they see that the cavern is at least 500 meters tall and 50 meters wide. Its formation is reminiscent of a monumental man-made hall, with a paved floor and walls composed of bricks and polished stones. Throughout the length of the corridor on both sides, a series of approximately 1,000 humanoid statues stand, depicting various members of the SCP-1000 race. All of them have their eyes closed and their hands folded, holding stone staffs embedded into the dirt. Despite no identifiable light source being present, the entire area is dimly lit and half filled with fog, and in the distance, a 30-meter-tall wall can be seen, made up of carefully crafted pillars and flanks. Magma is dripping from drains located inside of it, spitting the liquid out into a river, crossable only by a large stone bridge. In the center of the wall is an equally monumental gate, constructed in the form of a white-furred SCP-1000 instance with a key and crown above its head. The gate currently stands wide open, revealing a small corridor terminating in solid doors. On top of a connected gate tower, a 3-meter-tall figure stands in the shadows, looking at the team. The team lead begins to panic, asking command what their recommended course of action is, but another team member steps over and calms her down. Eventually, the team proceeds forward, but halfway to the gate, the statues all animate and begin to rhythmically pound their staffs into the floor, as well as chant in an unknown language. The team flinches and starts to run towards the gate, realizing that the statues are not actually statues, but rather gray-skinned SCP-1000 instances. They open their eyes and start to sing faster, as the figure atop the gate draws forth some sort of weapon from its back. Command then comes through the team lead's headset, informing her that they can't pull them out of there, as the Eve density is too high for apportation. The only recommendable course of action is continuing forward towards the gate, as there are now thousands of figures behind them. She begins to tremble and asks if they can at least identify what they're chanting. For a few seconds, no answer is heard, until Command tells her that they believe they're repeating the words for Fey Butchers in their language. She swears again as Command cuts out once more. As they approach the gate, the figure standing on the tower suddenly jumps forward, landing near them and forcing a cloud of smoke and dust into the air. It's revealed to be a 3.5 meter tall, white-furred SCP-1000, wearing heavy armor constructed from some organic metallic material, ending in steel gloves with giant knuckles. In its left hand, it's wielding a 2-meter sword, vibrating with heat from the magma inside of it. Above its scarred face, tainted with a single white eye, a crown-like yellow formation is levitating. The creature growls, grasping its other hand, causing brown sparks to fly out from the tips of its fingers. The headpieces of half the team explode from Eve overdose, and the creature furrows its brows, before suddenly laughing. It speaks in English, then, welcoming the children of Adam, and hoping their journey here was most pleasant. His voice is extremely rough, but is easily comprehensible, and he steps forward, extending his arms and smiling widely. He remarks that his messengers did not manage to welcome them properly, and he cannot imagine what a nightmare navigating these corridors must be for above-grounders. He then turns and starts to walk towards the gate, but after none of the team follows him, he turns with genuine surprise on his face. He asks what the matter is, as it would be quite a shame if heroes like them were to refuse a feast within the sacred city of Druv'tul. He was so excited to finally talk to their kind after all they'd done since they last met, although he did hope to converse with one of their leaders. He then puts his right arm onto the team lead's shoulders, causing her to flinch, and he says that he's sure that the rest of the guests are all restless by now. The team lead finally complies and follows him, signaling the others to follow as well. They all exchange nervous looks, but continue forward, eventually making their way into the tight corridor within the gate. After a couple of minutes, they come to a set of large wooden doors, which the creature opens while smiling. He welcomes them to Druv'tul al-Had, after more than 200 millennia, bidding them to feast together in memory of their recent brave deeds, for the night is still young. He laughs and gestures them to enter, as the camera feed gets filled with error after error, with every Eve and light parameter overloading. One by one, every Alpha-1 member disconnects, and the log terminates. Due to an overload of Eve radiation on a scale almost never seen before, both the camera and audio feeds of all team members were terminated. For the next 36 hours, no contact from the agents was initiated. After exactly 36 hours, however, the agents were suddenly teleported inside of their main quarters at Site 01. They were all perfectly intact, but were wearing highly unusual clothing and were extremely dirty. After immediately being detained and quarantined, scans proved that they were under no anomalous or thaumaturgic influence, and were merely slightly more Eve-radiated than expected. When this was confirmed, O54 personally requested an audit with the team lead, for the sake of detailed questioning in regards to their exploration mission. O54 asks the team lead, Samira Rodriguez, to tell him everything she can about her time down there, as anything she can remember is crucial information for the Council. Rodriguez takes a deep breath and closes her eyes, trying to gather her thoughts, before stating that they passed through into a corridor, larger than the one before it, and its decorations were something like those drawings of stars and working Yeren, but much, much more advanced. They were still the same scene, but crafted with much more care. She says that their composition was immaculate, almost, but the image still showed people carrying ingredients into plants and then sacrificing them into some magic beam shooting into a border in the sky. The corridor was long, and they walked for at least an hour, as the king kept that happy expression the whole time, even after they told him that they needed a break, many times. It was almost as if he didn't listen, just telling them that they needed to hurry to some feast, and how happy he was that the children of Adam visited the domain of his people once more. She's not sure if he did that with joy or some sort of insanity-driven passion, but he put significant weight on the word Adam every time. When they entered the city after hours of walking, the king changed from happiness to overbearing pride. She says that the city was nothing like they'd ever seen, with not even Alagada feeling that strange. It was simply monumental, on a scale that she didn't think was possible, and by all means shouldn't be possible. Their first contact was in some work district, with the sky at least 20 kilometers beneath the ceiling engulfed in a sea of fire, smoke, and dust. From every corner of the place, they could feel steps and voices, always murmuring about work, as that's all she could gather from what little Yeren she knows. They walked above them all on a golden bridge, with the king not even looking at the world beneath him. All she could see below were his subjects who greeted him, kneeling amongst flowing molten metal, suffocating smog, and deafening cracks in stone. They continued walking, but she says that upon entering the city, it's almost as if their exhaustion melted away. Their steps were accompanied by warmth, almost exuding from the myriad pipes and valves, while the world was illuminated by the fires and magma dripping down from the ceiling onto controlled casts and lakes. The people turned like gears, with every moment and every single movement they made somehow contributing to whatever machine they were making, even as they wandered streets engraved in symbols she didn't understand. 054 asks her to elaborate on those symbols, which she says were everywhere, seemingly untainted by all of the dirt. They covered the cobblestone streets of Druv-Tul in their various shapes and sizes, and were laid on every centimeter of the path. She shakes her head and says that it felt so surreal that it's difficult to talk about it without getting a bit emotional. 054 says that he understands, but asks if there was something to the city other than factories. She says that eventually, although she has no idea how long, they made it to the palace. They went through some golden pathways she feels are reserved for only those like the king, and they arrived in the single biggest area she's ever seen. She compares it to stargazing on a cloudless night, and the overwhelming notion of incomprehensible size, but applied in every direction. The cave of the inner sanctum is a place beyond size, time, and man itself, extending everywhere, forever. It was nearly unbearable, and though she's not cowardly, it struck fear into her heart, like it was telling her that she was unworthy to even look at it. From its ceiling, wherever it was, lava fell, filling an impossibly hot ocean around an equally impossible large and faraway island. She pauses to take multiple deep breaths and says that atop the island was the palace, calling it a monument to the capabilities of man, built from metal entangled with plants, standing large and proud in this undefeatable, incomprehensible space, as if it was challenging the rules of reality itself. Skyscraping towers waved flags covered with keys, stars, and crowns, and nearly blinding light shine from somewhere. This was all built around a tree so big that it reached above the structure, with a hollow middle, and it all just stood there, laughing at the world around it. Guided by the king, they went inside, and inside the castle was a feast. It was a feast like she'd never experienced, even in Alagada, making all of her senses explode with a billion feelings she didn't know existed. Walking through those halls felt like a fever dream, as her and her team navigated through 100 rooms with so many people that she couldn't even begin to describe it all. The thaumaturgically sensitive member of the team was bordering on insanity, experiencing all of the food and drinks and smells and sights. She could feel their every sense practically begging for help, but in their eyes, she could see that they didn't want it to stop. 054 asks what the feast was like, and Rodriguez says that they didn't join the festivities upon arrival, as the king took them to a large balcony overlooking the magma lake from 2 kilometers up. On its shore, they could see towering humanoid figures, standing and stretching forever into infinity, and in the sky above them, they could finally see that there were stars. She's sure that they were fake ones, but they looked like the real things, dancing around in those artificial cosmos, and they were brighter than what she'd known stars to look like, as if they were made by someone that had never seen them before. The king said something about liberation awaiting, as he pointed to his own virtual universe above his head. She can't really describe what it truly felt like, but the halls were filled with various SCP-1000 nobilities and mages, all carefully looking at them as they made their way towards their designated seats. They were the only ones that weren't filled by guests, with 5 of them bearing the names of her team, and the 6th one belonged to a name that's been redacted due to the 05 Council Identity Protection Protocol, suggesting that it's 054's real name. The king saw them to their chairs and told them to have fun. She thinks that they did, but she doesn't remember, as it went by infinitely fast and yet impossibly slow at the same time. It was as if time itself had unraveled into nothingness, all the while making her experience and consume things that were not meant for her brain or her soul. It was like a sickeningly real fever dream, tainted only by the sour smell of alcohol mixed with the sweet taste of the food. She's sure that their NOAA specialists will tell him more, because she just can't remember anything else, and all she can say for certain is that after more than a day of that, the king came to them again. He gently tapped them on the shoulders and said that it was time to go, although she could feel that he was disappointed. Before he sent them back, he leaned in close to her, uncomfortably so, and stared at the chair that had been empty all night. He stared and whispered to her that he wanted to talk to 054. Needless to say, Rodriguez had quite the experience there, and as per her own request, she was amnesticized regarding 054's name during her standard post-mission treatment. An additional granted request reduced the squad to non-vital mission status, with included holidays for the next month as a reward for their efforts. Immediately following that interview, 054 made his way into the Site-01 Summit Hall, where he proceeded to call a non-emergency meeting of the 05 Council, with only 6 of them present at the time. 058 enters and hears that 054 wishes to get the Council's permission for a venture into SCP-7600 by himself, causing her to scoff. She says that 054 has lost his mind and asks why they would allow one of their most important members to waltz into a Yeren metropolis at the center of the Earth, as if they didn't want to kill them for a billion different reasons. 051 sighs and replies that 7600 holds immense historical and research potential, which would undoubtedly provide answers to hundreds of questions they've never answered. 058 asks if that's why they're going to ignore all of their post-factory safety protocols and let him, of all people, barge in there like it's 1900 again. 054 replies that he is the best man for the job, although 058 says that actually Alpha 1 was, until they were put on vacation while the Foundation is uncovering the single most important thing of this decade. 054 tells her that she doesn't understand just how much he knows, and although he knows that she cares about him and the project, he is the best man for the job. She replies that he doesn't realize his importance to many things, people, and his position, and the need for him to not risk his life. 4 just turns to 1, asking if he can do something about her, as she's changed since he allowed her to de-age herself. 8 remarks that she made herself younger, not stupider, and being annoyed by some of his ideas is just a byproduct of not being bound by old people rules. 4 tells her to put it to a vote or to stop being an annoying little ontokinetic brat, as he hates to use their mom's argument here, but he is older and he knows better. 051 sighs again, telling them both to stop, and asking to hear arguments from both sides like civilized people. 054 goes first, stating that he believes his exploration of SCP-7600 and conversation with the King would not only yield extensive scientific results, but would likely allow them a rare opportunity to hopefully regulate the increasingly frequent Yeren appearances. They are beyond lucky to have been given such a chance, a near entirely random one at that, to finally understand what they've been yearning to know about their world for so long. While the dangers 8 outlined shouldn't be ignored, they have more than enough magic and technology on their hands to protect him from any harm that could befall him. He's sure that she also understands why he wants to go there, and why it's so important to their shared project. Should an incident occur regardless, which he finds more than doubtful, he nominates Judith Lowe of the History Department for his position. 058 tells 051 that if he genuinely needs to hear a speech from her to understand why putting 054 in danger is a terrible idea, then she doesn't think anything she would say would matter anyways. 051 sighs a third time, massaging his temples, before declaring that they'll put it to a vote. With the remainder of the council voting remotely, the motion narrowly passed. Following the approval of his expedition, 054 proceeded to be fully anti-thaumaturgically inoculated by Site-01 personnel, rendering him a perfect anti-magic sink for 1 week. This effect, combined with the numerous protective rituals, totems, and anti-ontokinetic pieces applied to him, render him practically invulnerable to any damage the 7600 citizens and surroundings could inflict upon him. However, to further ensure his safety, 054 was additionally equipped with an occult talisman bound to Site-01, the breaking of which would immediately return him to Site-01. Despite utilizing the same apportation ritual as Alpha 1, 054 found himself directly within the inner sanctum. The suspicion spawned from this incident nearly resulted in 054's immediate retrieval, but due to his personal override permissions, the mission continued. As reality stabilizes and the swirling ash falls to the ground, 054 begins to cough violently, covering his eyes in reaction to a nearby, blinding light. Moments later, a large, furred hand pierces through the barrier of illumination, and after a brief hesitation, during which 4 appears ready to activate the teleportation failsafe, he takes the hand and stands up. The King states that he's been waiting for him, as 4 looks around to see that he's in the center of a large hall constructed solely from steel-like metal and stone, with vine-like chandeliers flickering with green flames. The floor is carpeted in a royal crimson, which terminates at the base of a 10-meter-tall throne constructed from the melted-together remnants of golden keys. Behind it, a giant glass pane divides the repetitive wall design, looking out across the magma-filled lake. 054 looks back to the king, and the two shake hands, with the king stating that it is truly a pleasure to be able to welcome his kind once more to Druv'tul. 4 steps over to the window, telling the king that normally he wouldn't appreciate someone relocating the exit of his teleportation, but he thinks that a sight like this is enough for him to forgive him. The king chuckles and says that he thought 4 would want to come directly to the palace rather than bother with the city's usual entry pathways, especially with how their team's mission turned out. The two then stand in silence for a couple of minutes, looking out at the magma lake, before 4 remarks that the king said he wanted to see him, referring to him as 7600-K. The king raises an eyebrow and cracks a slight smile, telling him that he can just call him Metius. He did call 4 here, for a reason that he believes 4 will find most intriguing. He then extends his hand towards the glass, giving it a few precise touches before stepping back. The entire wall then proceeds to quickly destruct itself, the glass seeming to fade away entirely as the bricks reposition themselves into the formation of a balcony segment extending outside of the confines of the room. Once the reconstruction seems to complete, Metius takes a step forward, motioning 4 to follow. They emerge into an open grotto, extending in every direction until the end of the horizon. Approximately 2 kilometers below the palace, a lake is filled by the constant drip of magma from a ceiling so far up that clouds of smoke obfuscate it entirely. The two are protected from its heat by a transparent barrier surrounding the balcony. In the distance, the shores of the massive pool can be seen, where a series of 300-meter-tall humanoid statues stand, their arms extending towards the falling flows of magma, with constructs that appear similar to lanterns clasped within their hands, all unlit. 054 inhales deeply, about to speak, but he looks up and sees the artificial night sky, sparkling with starlight and planets and suns, just a fingertip's length away. It engulfs the place in a mirage of moving cosmos, which hovers just 100 meters above ground level. 4 extends his hand forward, causing one of the stars to come down towards his palm, bursting with light and comfortable warmth, before disappearing moments later. He simply stares at his hands, before asking Metius how, and more importantly, why they do all this. Metius also extends a hand, causing a star to fall down onto his palm, but this one doesn't burst. He instead gently throws it back up, where it shines even brighter. He tells 4 that he brought him down here because it would be difficult for their kind to understand what he truly wants to share without any of them seeing this first. He knows that he has many questions, and he will answer any of them more than gladly, but many of them he will simply have no answer for. For most of them, though, it goes back to that question of why. Why go to the effort of building all of this? Why not fight back for the right to live among humans? He has heard those 2 questions alone, a million times from the lips of every great man he has invited here over these endless millennia. He thinks that 4 will be the first to understand, however, so he'll share a story. Before humanity's time, his people created an empire so large that it spanned the entire globe, and they did things much more peacefully than those that came before them. They gave humanity warless homes so that they could live in the light as the Yeren did in the dark. From organic skyscrapers tall enough to hear infinity, to minds deep enough to make them feel their bounds. They were everywhere, always and forever in peace. They created a society that could not only thrive, but a society that could thrive in tandem with humanity. In the millennia that would come, however, Earth grew to be less than enough for the Yeren. They uncovered the mysteries of all the myths and legends that once shrouded the unknown, and everything to comprehend they understood thoroughly. With all the knowledge they had, they tried to expand upward to the myriad worlds above them, hoping to find a planet to host them, leaving the Yeren and humanity to live alone. The Queen, however, did not like that, referring to Queen Mab of the Fae. Somewhere from beyond her grave, she cursed them, casting chains upon them heavy enough to bind the entire species to Earth. She mockingly called them the Children of the Night, sentencing them to only forever wander said night, never to so much as touch the stars that shined so brightly they couldn't help but feel compelled to explore them. He turns away for a moment to pause, looking at a few Yeren in the distance, before saying that she made them disgusting. But in time, they found the cure. A god, Fomet, discovered a way to break the curse, a remedy that would free them from their past once and for all. The cost, however, for him, was too much, but he never told anyone the price of liberation, as he feared the rest of the Yeren would find it a toll they couldn't afford. Even that was not enough for the Queen, though, and she convinced humanity to aid her in overthrowing them, crowning them kings of the planet in less than a day. The Day of the Flowers, as everything seemed to bloom that night, even as they slaughtered the Yeren in their sleep, and their blood flooded the grass. They left the Yeren with no choice, and so they ran, and ran, and ran, until they were so deep within the depths of darkness that they were certain humanity's fragile, light-loving people wouldn't catch them. They could not save everyone, with those they left behind remaining above and living amongst humans. But the Yeren had to stand up for themselves. Metius smiles, turning back towards the palace, saying that since then, they have built, never stopping, until they formed a city proud enough to call home, even here. A place where they were safe, where nobody could reach them, and where they could thrive in peace once more. He sighs and says that it wasn't enough, however, and it never was. Blinded by hubris, perhaps, the king of the newly made Druv'tul once again looked towards the stars, not content with what his brother said about the price being too high. He reached to him, saying it was their time, but Fomet simply said that he was a fool if he truly thought that. For breaking Fomet's trust, Fomet left on a journey where he hoped to find peace and wisdom that he could share with who he thought were people that didn't yet understand what he truly could see in his enlightenment, even after all those years of guiding them. Metius points and nods towards the lanterns held by the giants, saying that they did what they always have, worked and worked, relentless to get their light in the darkness back, and to make themselves not rancid anymore. They created a plan, the sundown ritual, that would guide their beloved Fomet back home with a lantern so bright that it would be seen in all realities, no matter where he was stranded. He admits that it would be nearly impossible, but they had to try, for the Yeren, and for humanity, so that they could once more believe in a future as bright as the stars they so desperately loved. It was a price they were willing to pay, and simply had to pay, so they have worked without pause ever since in an effort to fulfill an impossible promise of a beautiful future. He looks to the floor in silence, and O54 doesn't respond for nearly 3 minutes as they look at the lake, until eventually 4 turns towards Metius and asks him why he's telling him all of this. Metius replies that he is one of the solemn few who truly understands loving the past more than wanting to celebrate the present. Also, because they are almost done, and he would not want to live through such a monumental moment alone. He couldn't bear to find a cure for their curse alone, without anyone else by him. Four is not sure he understands, and asks about his people, if they're not enough. Metius tells him that they both know that it's not the same, as they work, and they appreciate that he gives their lives purpose, but they don't really get it. They're not fully people, they just work. They are content with the curse put upon them, and in this simplicity, they are repulsive, living without dreams. He needs to fix them, no matter what price it takes. For them, he can do it, but they don't get it, and nobody ever has except for Four, a man that, similarly to him, sees that what came before them is more important than what surrounds them now. Four then asks about the others of their kind that live above ground, as surely they would understand at least a little. Metius smiles sadly and says that they would not, as they don't even know their past, so how could they make it their life's purpose? They're even more rancid and need to be fixed even more. Besides, they barely allow non-Fomitians inside of the city, as he would not want someone that cannot believe in what he stood for to work for him, especially someone as violent as them. After a brief pause, Four asks how he knows all of that, to which Metius reveals that he was there to see it, and that he was that foolish, foolish king. After another pause, Four asks why him specifically, after all he and his colleagues have done, after the factory that he didn't stop. Metius tells him that it's because he doesn't believe any price is too great for wisdom, and Four has paid quite the hefty debt for his perspective. Four doesn't respond, looking at the border between the palace and the rings, seeing multiple citizens attempting to breach the border, only to be stopped by guards. Metius asks if he'll help him, as he can and will provide any and all answers for his questions if he simply listens to an old man as the fires finally burn and Fomet comes home. All he asks for is company during what would most likely be his final day, as he needs someone to help him bear the burden of the price he needs to pay. He extends his hand, and Four hesitates before accepting, telling him to show him what he can do to help, and he'll try his best to assist. Before their hands touch to shake, however, Four extends his pinky finger, looking Metius directly in his eyes and moving his wrist in a circular manner whilst whispering an inaudible phrase. Red lightning sparkles around himself, rendering the agreement a thaumaturgic death oath, meaning that if Four breaks his word, he'll immediately die. Metius nods and puts his arm around Four's shoulder, telling him to come with him, as there is still much work to be done. So, it turns out that there's quite a few Bigfoot left, and they've spent tens of thousands of years building the biggest city the world has ever seen, all to create a beacon for their lost god to return to. They want Fomet to return to relieve them of the curse that Queen Mab placed on most of them, sapping them of their dreams. Fomet never told Metius or anyone else of the price that it would cost to remove the curse, fearing that it was far too great, but Metius is willing to pay it regardless. In part 2, we'll see how Four gets along with the Yeren, what the other council members think about all this, and how exactly the sundown ritual works. Needless to say, We haven't gotten the whole picture of everything going on with the Yeren, and the resulting confrontation is sure to be climactic.